Park Row Books and Harper Audio present The Lying Club by Annie Ward, performed by Terry Schnaubelt. For my family, friends, and 2 decades of great teammates, we are the Wolves. Wolfpack by Abby Wambach, U.S. Soccer Olympic gold medalist. Prologue. The necktie of her ex was still clasped in her hand when Natalie woke. Her head was pounding, and her mouth tasted bad, like she'd fallen into bed without brushing her teeth. She had a horrible, cloudy feeling that she'd done something regrettable, but in that moment, she couldn't remember what it was. She wasn't at home. Instead, she was upright, a seatbelt crossing her chest. In front of her was the windshield of her own car, coated in a sheet of frost, and her I Love Colorado keychain was dangling from the ignition. Natalie realized then that she'd blacked out. It had happened before, when she was much younger, and the memory of that awful awakening hit her with an electrifying jolt. After a frantic inspection, she concluded that all her clothes were on and nothing seemed torn or altered. She slipped the tie into her coat pocket. Yanking the rearview mirror toward her face, she saw that her hazel eyes were huge, the pupils tiny pinpoints, and her mascara was smudged. A chapped crack ran down the bottom of her lower lip, but there were no other bruises or cuts. It didn't appear that she'd crashed into a building or a tree. There were no sirens. She rolled down her window and a thin wall of ice collapsed into the car, dampening her plaid skirt. It was almost dark outside. Work. She was at work. Across the snowy parking lot, she could see the back door to the east wing of the private school where she was an administrative assistant in the front office. Pulling on her stocking cap and opening the car door, Natalie noticed footprints, slightly softened by snowfall, leading from her car to the rear exit of the school's gym. Another set of identical prints returned from the door to the car, but not in a straight line. They zigzagged, and there was a large compression in the snow, just about the size of a small person like her. Gingerly, she lowered one boot into the first of the prints to make sure it was a match. It was. It seemed likely that the body-shaped spot in the snow was an indication that she'd fallen, and a quick pat down of her coat confirmed that it was wet. Natalie stepped out of her car and squinted into the wind. Her legs felt weak, as if she'd just returned from one of her longer runs. She retraced her own tracks leading to the school. The sky was changing color from a grayish stormy dusk to night, and it struck Natalie, who loved art, that the swirling white flurries between her and the stars resembled a monochrome Van Gogh painting. Snow-capped peaks surrounded her on all sides. Down the mountain was the town center. Lights twinkled. Houses, vacation condos, and old-timey shops were piled like Christmas gifts on top of one another alongside a dark and twisting river. The heavy back door was ajar. When she tugged on it, it groaned, scraped, and opened. Heart pounding, she went in. During school hours, the sports pavilion would have been filled with the sound of bouncing basketballs, laughter, whistles, and sneakers squeaking on the gym floor. Now there was distant, droning pop music playing up on the mezzanine, but no one was singing along or dropping weights to the floor with a crash. Natalie walked with slow, hesitant steps over to the double doors that opened onto the basketball courts. Normally, those doors stood propped open by gray rubber wedges. Now they were closed, but each had a rectangular window. Natalie curled her hand and made a cup for her eyes. It took a second to see anything at all. The court was dim, aglow only from the small green emergency lights situated over the doors and in the corners of the room. Her eyes were adjusting. Something was there. She jumped away from the door as if the glass had burned her skin. Her hands flew up to cover her mouth. A scream almost escaped, but she stopped it in her throat with a choking noise. Not far from the door was what looked like a crumpled pile of clothes and broken body parts, motionless in the middle of a spreading pool of blood. What the hell did I do? The security lights in the Falcon Academy parking lot flickered. It was early Monday morning and still dark. A beat-up Pathfinder left tracks in the snow as it swerved into a spot reserved for employees. Harry Doyle climbed out and used his heel to squelch a cigarette into the ground. He grabbed a battered baseball cap from the dashboard and plopped it on his head, holding down what little was left of his hair. After slamming the driver's door shut, he looked up at the sky, which was turning pink and orange to the east. An enormous blanket of fluffy white covered the parking lot. Last night had been the first big storm of the season, and some parents would call their kids in sick so they could hit the slopes with their friends. The 68-year-old custodian shuffled towards the rear entrance of the sports pavilion. The automatic fluorescents in the back hallway glowed a sickly yellow. He hummed as he plodded down the hall to the boys' changing room, where he put his lunch and jacket away in his locker before going to the storage closet. Harry grabbed the fiberglass handle of the deluxe wet mop and hauled it and the bucket out into the corridor toward the basketball courts. Pushing past the double doors, he activated all 9 light switches with a swipe of his hand. The bulky, caged gymnasium overheads burst to life with a buzz.
What the hell? He exclaimed, dropping the mop.
The handle clattered against the maple wood planks.
Oh, dear God.
The words came out strangled. Harry scrambled for his phone in a zippered compartment of his slacks.
Hello?
He managed to say after dialing 911. He was having trouble breathing.
The Falcon Academy, off Highway 70, just west of Blackswift. Oh, Jesus. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. We need help. There's a lot of blood.
KBEV 16, breaking news. Melissa O'Hare here, coming to you first on the scene as a major situation is unfolding at one of our local schools. What we know so far is that, not long ago, the sound of sirens shattered the early morning tranquility here outside Big Elk Estates. As you can see behind me, there's a massive police response at the Falcon Academy, a private and well-respected institution in a safe and affluent community. While authorities have declined to comment on the identities of the 2 people carried out of Falcon Academy several hours ago, one spokesperson for authorities indicated that an investigation is already underway. A person of interest has been identified and detained for questioning. Sources at Colorado Mountain Medical say that the next 12 hours will be key in determining whether the police are dealing with an accident, aggravated assault, or homicide. I'm Melissa O'Hare, and I'll be keeping you up to date as this story unfolds. 6 months earlier. 1. A Honda Civic was waved into the Big Elk Estates gated community by a young security guard who looked at the car with interest for 2 reasons. First, this was a Lexus, Hummer, Rover kind of neighborhood, and the Civic wasn't just a cheap old car, it was sporting some paint damage and dents. Second, the 20-something woman driving it was attractive, with bobbed auburn hair, bright red lips, and fun, oversized sunglasses. She waved at him, and he waved back enthusiastically. Every other car that had entered the estate that day had been driven by frowning retirees in sun visors. Natalie parked in front of the open house, along with 12 other cars. It was a breathtaking, sprawling, contemporary mountain mansion with huge windows and a beautiful rock garden speckled with ochre and coral-colored stones. She stood on the immense front lawn for a second, just taking in the magnificence while the breeze caused her drop-waisted dress to flutter around her thighs. She unzipped and removed her ankle boots in the foyer and stood there barefoot for a moment, enjoying the feel of the cool marble floor while looking up at the stained glass window over the front door. The artwork depicted a doe nuzzling a fawn in a field of yellow flowers with a forest in the background. Natalie pulled out her phone and snapped a quick photo. Then she grabbed a pair of the little sock booties that were required to walk around the house, slipped them on, and began to explore. Upstairs, in the master bedroom, a short, curvy brunette with thick, long, dark hair was describing the distinctive antique chandelier to a small group of visitors. Natalie was familiar with the real estate agent, Asha, after showing up at her open houses on and off for a few months. Asha had a son and daughter at Falcon Academy, Oliver and Mia. Oliver had never been in trouble, but Mia was outspoken, opinionated, and confident. She was described by some teachers as a girl who took no shit, and by others as a pain in the ass. Natalie liked Mia. "Notice the bronze has a patina of copper, gold, green, and ivory," Asha was saying, "which coexists so beautifully with the view of the mountains through the floor-to-ceiling French doors." Asha had begun rapturously describing the teardrop crystals hanging down above everyone's heads when she caught sight of Natalie and paused. Mid-20s, and dressed more suitably for a concert than a tour of a $9 million home, Natalie was conspicuous among the well-heeled potential buyers. A split second later, Asha continued her presentation. The way she moved her hands was so graceful and expressive, it was almost as if she were dancing. She waved hello to an elderly man and woman who were re-entering the master bedroom from the adjoining bath. "Excuse me for a minute," Asha said to her captive audience. "Please, explore." She inhaled with delight, as if to suggest that the aroma of the house alone was enough to make everyone fall in love. "Take it all in." Asha steered the elegant, aging couple towards the spectacular view and stood between them, chatting about how blessed they all were to be able to live in the Rockies. For the next half hour, Natalie took her time meandering about the soon-to-be-sold home of a certain Falcon Academy parental power duo. They were unpleasant people, so Natalie was surprised to find that they had excellent taste in art. The missus had probably hired an interior decorator from one of the coasts. Natalie was somewhat sure that they had been unhappily married because Yvonne, her friend and coworker in the front office at Falcon, had told her a story about being out for drinks in town and running into the husband. Yvonne said a pleasant hello, and he put a hand against the wall to keep her from advancing to the restroom.
"I've always had a thing for Asians," he'd said,
and Yvonne had ducked under his arm and walked quickly away. With a husband like that, it came as no surprise to Natalie that the wife, though having cleaned out most of the bathrooms and closets, had left a few errant Xanax pills scattered at the very back of the bathroom drawer in the guest ensuite, along with a wine bottle opener, a lighter, and half a pack of Marlboro Lights. Natalie pocketed only the pills. 5 minutes later, she sat on the bottom step of the main staircase, tugging the elastic booties off her feet. Asha appeared on the staircase above her and said, "Are you heading out?"
"I am," Natalie said. "I've got some plans."
"Anything fun?" Asha asked, sinking to a seat on the step beside her. There were hardly any people left. The house was closing in a few minutes.
"I'm going to see my brother and take his dog for a hike."
"Good weather for it," Asha said. "I'm going to my daughter's soccer game."
"Mia, right?" Natalie asked.
"Oh, you know her?"
"Of course I do. She's the soccer star."
"That's very kind of you to say," Asha nodded in a humble way. "Yes, Mia's quite good. No thanks to me. I can barely walk and chew gum at the same time. But my husband was sporty when he was younger."
"I thought the school's soccer season was in the fall."
"It is," Asha said. "But some of the girls play year-round. Indoor in winter and club teams in the spring."
"You have a son as well, don't you?" Natalie asked.
"Oliver, in sixth grade, plays the trombone."
"Yes, I do,"
Asha answered. She regarded Natalie with a puzzled tilt of her heart-shaped face.
"You've been to several of my open houses now."
"Six total." Natalie checked her phone for notifications. "And I've been to a few of your competitors, too. Yours are way better usually. You do a really good job."
"Thank you for that," Asha paused. "May I ask you something?"
"Ask away." Asha fiddled with the back of one of her earrings, hesitantly. Natalie expected the question to be, "Why exactly are you here?"
but after a second she said, "You like art, don't you?"
"I do,"
Natalie answered, putting her phone away in her purse and hoisting the strap up on her shoulder, indicating she was ready to leave.
"I've noticed you spend a lot of time in front of the paintings."
"Sometimes I'd just like to be around beautiful things and take stuff and pretend for a minute that this is my life too." Natalie stood and walked towards the door to retrieve her shoes.
"Who doesn't like beautiful things?"
Asha asked in a rhetorical way. Rumored around the school to be related to some long-dead Maharaja, Asha came from money and worked only for pleasure.
"Did you like this house?"
What a dumb question. No, every inch of the luxurious 10,000 square feet is offensively uninhabitable.
"I did," Natalie answered. "But you know what? I like them all. They're more fun to look at than the four walls of my studio, that's for sure."
"Oh, well," Asha said in a tone that lacked her earlier warmth.
"With some luck, you'll find the right one eventually. Fingers crossed."
Natalie paused, sensing that there was an insinuation, however nicely veiled. Dropping her sunglasses over her eyes, she said,
"I'll keep my fingers crossed for you too."
"Excuse me?"
"Your daughter's soccer game." Natalie punched the air. "Go Falcons."
"Oh, right, of course."
Asha made a face and then swiftly covered her mouth with her fist. "Everything all right?"
Natalie paused to ask.
"Yes, thank you. My stomach. Probably just nerves about the game. After all these years, I've still never gotten quite used to how stressful this sports stuff can be."
Natalie said, unconvinced. As she walked out of the house, backlit by the bright sun, she called over her shoulder,
"It will be fine. I'm sure you'll win big. Seems like you always do."
2.
"Beautiful," Brooke Elliman said under her breath as she watched her daughter, Sloane, maneuvering down the soccer field, faking this way, then that, dribbling around the other team's players with a speed and agility that were truly rare. Brooke was filming her daughter's performance through her new Panasonic high-definition camcorder, and the quality was amazing. She could zoom in on Sloane to see the concentration on her face and the muscle definition in her strong legs. The camera captured everything from the leaves rustling in the trees on the far side of the field to the flecks of sweat staining Sloane's jersey. Sloane had a breakaway. Brooke's hand shook a little with excitement and nerves while she filmed, and she leaped to her feet, careful to avoid the REI luxury pop-up canopy she was seated underneath.
"It's all you, Sloane. You've got this."
Sloane crossed the ball to a teammate in the center who took the shot. The ball went over the goal, and the two girls backpedaled away to wait for the opposing team's goal kick. Brooke stopped recording. She irritably spun her wedding band around in circles on her right ring finger, where she'd moved it after Gabe had left. Her engagement diamond was at home in the safe. Standing on the sideline was Nicholas McGuire, who, in a somewhat unorthodox but dedicated role, coached soccer not only for the Falcon Academy varsity team, but also for several local club teams. He was clapping his hands and shouting,
"Nice pass, good work, almost."
He darted a look in Brooke's direction and gave her a quick wave, which she quickly returned. She began mentally composing a text to send to him after the game. Glancing towards the sidewalk, Brooke saw that Asha Wilson had finally arrived. Asha's daughter Mia had been playing club soccer with Sloane since they were first graders, and they were the only two freshmen to have been selected for the varsity team. Asha and Brooke weren't close friends, but they had spent many enjoyable hours seated next to each other over the years, cheering on the girls. They often commiserated about the many injuries their daughters had incurred, and had spent a dozen or so weekends together in random hotels across the Midwest for travel tournaments. On several such occasions, they'd met in the bar and had a few drinks. Brooke had once told Asha that she wished they could get to know each other better. Brooke didn't have any good female friends. She had tried to nudge the friendship with Asha along by inviting her and her husband Phil to dinner, but the well-intentioned invitation had backfired. Asha had not been happy that Brooke kept refilling Phil's wine glass until he was slurring about the stock market and investment opportunities in Telluride. Neither was Asha happy when she found the two of them sharing a joint on the back patio by the pool after Phil had excused himself to use the bathroom. It had been back to soccer mom-only friends ever since. Brooke waved Asha over and patted the empty chair. "Hello," Asha said, sinking into the seat with a slight groan and her hand on her stomach. She scanned the field. "Where's Mia?" "She's on the bench right now." Asha looked concerned. "Really? Why?" Even though they were the youngest players on the team, Mia and Sloane were already the best. "Not sure," Brooke said, "but it looked like maybe she was limping a little." Asha slapped the arm of her chair. "It must be the shin splints." "That doesn't sound too serious." Brooke appraised Asha's outfit. "You're awfully dressed up." She herself was attired in the color-coordinated mesh athletic ensemble that she'd worn earlier to her advanced cardio kickboxing class. "You look great. I can't be bothered anymore to put on makeup for soccer." This was less than truthful. Brooke did care about looking good for games, because the two men she cared about most were in attendance, her husband, Gabe, and coach Nick. Her keratin-treated hair hung down over her torso in a sleek Demi Moore curtain. Though she did appear to be free of makeup, she had eyelash extensions and filler-plumped lips and still looked stunning. "I usually can't be bothered either," Asha responded. "But I just came straight from a showing." The referee blew the whistle. "Halftime," Brooke said, reaching down to the ground to retrieve a clear plastic tumbler of iced green tea. Asha suddenly sat up and pointed down at the ground by Brooke's feet. "That's a nice video camera." "It is. I'm loving it. Have a look." She handed it to Asha, who held it up to her eye. "I got it so I can start filming for Sloane's highlight reel. Coach Nick told me most parents just use iPhones, but I wanted to make sure the quality was top-notch." After sitting quietly for a while, Asha asked, "I guess you're talking about the videos you send to college coaches for the whole recruiting process. Isn't it early to be thinking about that?" "No, actually. Coach Nick told me that most of the Division I colleges have filled their rosters by the end of the girls' sophomore years, so I've got to get busy sending emails and planning visits soon." Asha made a funny noise, similar to the groan that had escaped as she'd sat down in the camp chair. "Are you all right?" Brooke asked. Asha didn't answer. Brooke put a hand on her arm. "Do you want to talk about it? I'll drop it if that's what you prefer, but you can tell me anything." Asha thought about it for a second and then whispered, "I've got the weirdest feeling I might be pregnant." Brooke had not expected this. "Oh, my," she responded, bewildered. "Yeah," Asha said. "Oh, my" wasn't my first reaction. Mine was more like, "Oh, my God, what the hell is going on with me?" After a second, Brooke grinned. "Well, congratulations, then." But, back to rubbing her stomach, Asha said softly, "Phil and I are having some issues." "No, not you two. I'm so sorry." Brooke waited, but Asha just chewed on her lip and didn't speak. "Whatever it is, it can't be worse than what's going on in my life, right?" Brooke laughed. "Look over there. See Gabe with his little Broncos sun umbrella and aviator sunglasses? He's sitting on the other side of the field so he doesn't have to talk to me. Your husband hasn't moved out and started sleeping with his spin instructor, has he?"
No, but..."
Asha shook her head.
"Lately he's working a lot more than he used to, and when he's home, he just wants to go to bed. I mean, and not with me. Just by himself. Go down to the basement bedroom where it's quiet, turn off the lights and get under the covers and sleep. And when he's awake, he's in a terrible mood. I've tried everything. Talk more, talk less, touch him, leave him alone, cook him something he likes, don't cook anything because he's not hungry."
Asha buried her face in her hands. "Oh no, that's got to be hard," Brooke said.
"But you know, if you've got a baby on board, something must still be working between you two."
Brooke gave her mischievous side eye. "Unless..." Asha sat up, dabbing at one eye.
"I wasn't with anyone else. I wouldn't. But the last time with Phil was like 2 months ago."
At a loss for what to say, Brooke was saved by the referee, who took to the field and blew his whistle, summoning the teams.
"Oh," she said, obviously relieved. "Look, halftime is over. Here we go.
Let's go, girls!"
Asha yelled, sounding more exhausted than excited. God, I could use about 100 naps. I'm sick to my stomach, tired, and so forgetful lately. I lost my favorite bracelet today.
Was the bracelet insured? Brooke herself didn't own a single item of jewelry that wasn't worthy of its own policy.
No, that's too bad.
Brooke clapped lightly as the girls began to take the field.
Where did you lose it?
At the open house.
Someone stole it, Brooke said in an end-of-story way.
That's what happened. When Gabe and I sold our second home, someone who came to see it took a very rare and valuable old book off the shelf in the library. The thief was only caught when he tried to sell it.
I guess it's possible, Asha said. I went to the Sherwoods' house last night to finish staging it for today. I took the bracelet off and put it in this little decorative dish on the kitchen counter and then forgot about it. I remembered it this afternoon when I was about to close up and it wasn't there.
Asha looked sadly at her wrist. The missing bracelet was her favorite. After a second, she said,
Do you think it's strange that the front desk girl comes to a lot of my open houses?
What girl?
The front desk girl from the school, the headmaster's assistant.
Brooke frowned.
The Korean girl with the stud in the side of her nose? No, the other one. There's two. They sit side by side.
Oh, Brooke said. I know who you mean. The redhead with the Betty Page bangs who always looks like she has somewhere better to be.
Her name is Miss Bellman, Natalie Bellman.
Why should she be looking at multi-million dollar houses? She's probably the one who stole your bracelet.
Oh, look, go time, and Mia's back in.
Brooke hooked her fingers into the sides of her mouth and whistled. Come on, ladies! She switched on her camcorder and started to film. The two girls wore their hair the same way for games and had done so for years. It was parted in the middle in French braids, with the pigtails hanging down their backs. They were playing right wing and left wing, and after kickoff, Mia took the ball and ran with it. Sloane was sprinting down the opposite side, and the girl playing in the center was yelling,
You've got time! You've got time!
Mia reached the corner, maneuvered around a defensive player, and crossed the ball. Sloane jumped up and used her forehead to drive the ball towards the upper right corner of the goal. It was perfect. Brooke recorded a few seconds of applause and then pressed stop on her camera. She dropped it behind her into the chair and screamed,
Good job, girls!
On the other side of the field, Coach Nick was looking in her direction. Brooke placed both of her hands against her mouth and blew a big congratulatory kiss. She fell into her seat, happy. And then she had a thought that sent an icy shudder down the back of her neck. It was just a casual gesture, that kiss not open to interpretation. No one in the crowd could find anything wrong with a simple gesture like that. Except Gabe. Had Gabe seen? Brooke looked across to where her husband was seated by himself. His aviator sunglasses still covered his eyes, and one ankle was still crossed casually over the opposite knee, as if he hadn't reacted at all to their daughter's goal.
Brooke, Brooke!
Sorry, what?
Did you get that?
Asha asked. She was beaming.
Tell me you got that great play.
Sure did, Brooke answered, trying to forget the stupid blown kiss. The whole awesome thing.
Is there any way you could send it to me?
Of course, I'd be happy to. I have your email.
Great, thanks. I guess I need to get to work on Mia's highlight reel.
Wait, Brooke said, swiveling in her chair to face Asha. Are you looking at Division One now? I thought you said you wanted to keep Mia close to home.
I did, I still do, but she's got other ideas. She changes her mind every other day. One second it's a private liberal arts college and a psychology degree. The next it's finding a program that offers a semester at sea because she's going to be a marine biologist. Recently she's been talking about bigger schools with good film programs. In California, I can't keep up.
In California, Brooke echoed. She didn't look happy.
Yes, why is it that so many kids have their hearts set on California?
Because it's amazing, beautiful, and exciting.
Asha laughed. I forgot. You went to college in California, didn't you?
UCLA, Brooke answered. I'm a Bruin.
That's the school Mia keeps talking about the most.
If so, that would be because she's heard Sloane talking about it. Brooke's aggressive tone was lost on Asha, who answered,
Probably. Anyway, I appreciate you sending me the clip. I'll get my own video recorder this week.
Brooke nodded.
Right. Sure, absolutely.
Asha's phone rang and she stood up, mouthing,
Offer. She walked away to take the call. When she came back, the game was almost over. The two women didn't speak again until they said their goodbyes.
See you soon, Brooke, Asha called. Take care.
You too, Brooke answered coldly, without looking up from an agitated struggle to fold up her camp chair and shove it into its bag. Sloane seemed like she was in a bad mood when Brooke walked across the field to give her a post-game hug.
Great job, sweets, Brooke said.
Thank you.
Where's your dad? His chair was gone. She shaded her eyes and looked around. Gabe should have been waiting on the sidewalk.
He left.
What? He was supposed to be taking you out to dinner.
I asked him if he minded if we did a rain check. I'm not really in the mood.
Okay, Brooke said. No worries. Should I go ahead and make us a reservation at Café Provence? You can bring a friend. Ask Mia.
I don't want to ask Mia.
Sloane was looking off into the distance and waved at a tall, broad-shouldered boy with tousled bangs slouching against the goalpost.
Can I just go hang out with Reed?
Reed was an older boy Sloane had been talking about for months. They had recently started to seem like they were a couple. Brooke said,
You know what? Why don't I take you and Reed to dinner? I can get to know him a bit better. That would be fun.
What?
Sloane shook her head.
No. Ugh. I'd rather go on my own, if that's okay. Reed's waiting. Please, Mom.
But it would be so nice if-
Mom! No, it wouldn't.
The look on Sloane's face was the clincher. She was not going to come around.
All right, then, Brooke said. Go ahead.
Sloane turned to leave, and Brooke glanced about self-consciously to see if anyone had heard their conversation. No one was listening, so Brooke called and waved with a pleasant look on her face.
Great game! Okay, then. See you later. You two have fun.
Brooke watched her daughter join Reed, and there was something she didn't like about the way the boy grabbed her around the waist and pulled her into his body so they could walk hip to hip. Reed was two grades above Sloane. A couple of years earlier, Brooke had taken a yoga workshop with his free-spirited mom, Linda. The two women had tea once together after class and exchanged numbers. Still, for all intents and purposes, Brooke was letting her daughter walk off with a stranger. A distant memory tugged at her. Linda, at that yoga class, crying, telling the instructor about the unexpected death of one of Reed's friends. Brooke hadn't been able to hear much of the conversation and had continued to stretch on her own in the corner. She didn't really know Reed's mom all that well, and Linda stopped going to yoga after that. In fact, she'd gone off the local radar almost completely. As Brooke lost sight of her daughter over the top of the hill, she hoped that Reed was doing okay. It would be hard, she thought, to move on after the unexpected death of a classmate. Police video excerpt. Falcon Academy conference room interview. Bellman, Natalie Marie. 1:25 p.m. The video pans quickly across a room with a big table in the center and a bookcase at the back, followed by an extreme close-up of fingers moving in front of the lens. A young woman's voice can be heard asking,
You're going to film me?
Another woman, Detective Beth Larson, answers,
Yes, give me one sec to adjust the phone on the tripod.
The camera stops shaking. Detective Larson's fingers pull away. In the frame now is Natalie Bellman, seated catty-corner from Detective Ken Bradley. On the table in front of him are a pen, a pad of paper, his cell phone, a bottle of water, and a little brown can of double-shot espresso. Natalie has nothing. Her elbows rest on the arms of her chair, and her hands are clasped, held close to her body. Her chest is moving up and down visibly, but she is breathing through her nose. Detective Bradley looks up. He calls to Detective Larson.
Is your phone all set?
Good to go, she answers. Recording.
Detective Bradley places a stack of papers on the table, held together by a binder clip.
There's a photocopy of her Winnie the Pooh planner, if you want to get started reading, Beth, he says.
He emphasizes the words Winnie the Pooh and gives Natalie a sarcastic smile, as if he finds it amusing or perhaps just plain bizarre. Natalie avoids eye contact with him in a way that suggests he's managed to embarrass her. Detective Larson ducks swiftly in and out, scooping up the document. Natalie's chest rises and falls even faster. She narrows her eyes in a way that is open for interpretation. Hostility? Suspicion? Terror?
I'm Detective Ken Bradley,
the man says for the purpose of the recording.
And I'm in the Falcon Academy conference room with my partner, Detective Beth Larson. Both of us are from Denver Major Crimes.
He points at Natalie.
Can you go ahead and confirm your full name and address?
Natalie Marie Bellman, 11846 Blacktail Mountain Road, apartment 12.
And your title here at Falcon Academy?
Administrative assistant.
Can you please tell us again, and in more detail this time, what you were doing in the sports pavilion yesterday afternoon and again later that evening?
I was looking for... Detective Bradley drops his big hand down on the conference table with an exasperated sigh. The plastic Poland Spring water bottle falls over. Natalie twitches and goes quiet.
Sorry,
he says.
Go on.
I told you once already. I was looking for my earbuds that I had misplaced the previous day while I was working out in the mezzanine, and which I eventually found behind the treadmill. It sounds rehearsed. She is a bad actress. Detective Bradley shakes his head and cracks open his canned espresso.
You're going to stick with that story for now? Fine. We've got a long day ahead of us, Natalie. What really happened?
I told you. If you'd like me to, I'd be happy to tell you again. Detective Bradley turns to face his partner, standing back behind the camera.
Beth, do you get the impression everyone around here is full of it, or is it just me?
From behind the camera, Detective Larson responds, Not just you. Natalie sighs and looks away.
It's called lying, Natalie.
Detective Bradley leans in, close enough to be intimidating.
Look at me.
She does. He points a finger in her face.
I think you are lying.
3. Natalie's job as a front office administrative assistant was not exciting. That was just a fact. Over the course of the day, she would answer phones, type newsletters, send emails, cut out decorations to hang in the hall, rifle through the lost and found looking for name tags sewn into jackets, chat with Yvonne, and drink several cups of chamomile tea. She'd had plenty of jobs that weren't as sedentary. Bike messenger, Grubhub driver, instructor at a paint-while-you-drink wine franchise in Denver, where her specialty had been a Saturday afternoon paint-your-pet class. She still made a little money selling her animal portraits on the Etsy website. It wasn't that she was unhappy, really, with the job at the school. Her weekends and evenings were her own to hike, bike, paint, read, and watch television, and she preferred being deeper in the mountains to the traffic, construction, and flat urban sprawl of Denver. It was also fun to be close to her brother, Jay. At first, a year and a half earlier, when Jay had asked her if she was interested in coming out to help him recover from his biking accident, she'd been hesitant. Yes, he could compensate her nicely, thanks to his arrangement with the rich, drunk old man who'd run him down. But Natalie had her own life, a handful of friends, their mom, and at that time, a summer job she liked as a server at the rooftop terrace bar of the Le Méridien downtown. Jay said, fine, no problem, but a week later he was asking again.
I know you're making good tips at the hotel bar, Nat, he'd said, but my settlement is pretty big. Look, I should be able to walk in a few months. It's not forever, and the lady from care.com is a sweetheart, but if I'm going to pay someone $20 an hour to get my groceries and empty my bedpan, I'd rather it be you.
Gross, she said, but in the end her answer was yes. She and Jay had been close their whole lives, especially after their dad left when they were kids. 4 months later, Jay was able to walk with a cane and required less assistance from Natalie. She'd considered going back to Denver, but Jay still needed a lot of help, and truthfully, she liked Falcon Valley better than home. Her mom was conflicted about it. She missed having Natalie close, but she liked the fact that her kids were looking out for one another. Ultimately, Natalie decided to stay in Falcon Valley and randomly applied for jobs until she landed the position as Headmaster Dilly's assistant. She soon learned that, due to the affluence of the surrounding suburbs as well as the sky-high tuition, Falcon students were of a certain ilk. They were almost all filthy rich. A lot of the kids began to exhibit signs of entitlement around fifth grade. but the little ones were adorable and fresh as apples, unspoiled and sweet. No job was perfect, of course. Natalie accepted the fact that she would be blamed if a child's expensive, misplaced Patagonia parka was not located in the lost and found. She didn't like it, but she learned to live with it. After work sometimes, she and Yvonne and a couple of teachers would get together and talk and laugh behind the parents' backs. That was satisfying. Natalie was a little disappointed that her life had become so predictable, since she had always thought great adventure lay just around the next corner. She wanted to see the Sydney Opera House, the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, and the Great Wall of China, to own a loft with enough space for a real art studio in Chicago. But there was something to be said for a sense of security. Having healthcare was important, as was a steady paycheck and an employer who was decent. Occasionally, she dated. There were nights out with Yvonne, fulfilling her need for laughter and girl gossip. Natalie and Jay binge-watched Netflix on Friday nights, ordering in nachos and chicken wings. When she began to feel nostalgic, wronged, and unhappy about what had happened after her dad left, and she went off the rails for a while, she could always take one or two of Jay's Vicodins and paint in a dreamy ebb and flow of contented numbness until the bad feelings and memories of the things she'd done were completely forgotten. She didn't yet know that this mostly peaceful life of hers was soon to change. It was a rainy spring afternoon in the mountains. All after-school sports at Falcon Academy had been moved indoors. Natalie's workday had ended at 4. 30 minutes later, she entered the sports pavilion with her earbuds, her phone, a towel, and a bottle of water. This was a first for her. She'd only recently been told by Lars Jaeger, the school athletic director, that she was welcome to use the state-of-the-art fitness equipment in the sports pavilion after school and on weekends. As she walked towards the stairs leading to the mezzanine training area, she passed Nicholas McGuire. Parents and teachers called him Mr. McGuire, but the kids called him Coach Nick. He was working with a dozen girls at the far end of the basketball court. The collective sound of all of them breathing heavily as they ran shuttle sprints filled the auditorium.
"Let's go, ladies,"
he yelled, pacing back and forth.
"If you aren't here to do your best, you're wasting my time and yours."
Natalie paused at the edge of the bleachers to watch. The girls were pink-faced and panting, beads of lotion-scented sweat dripping onto the court. One girl, Mia Wilson, stopped running and bent over with her hands on her knees. Coach Nick blew the whistle that hung around his neck.
"On second thoughts, let's take a little water break."
He ran over to Mia and crouched down in front of her. They talked quietly, and eventually he led Mia over to the bleachers, where she sat, hanging her head between her knees. Coach Nick stayed beside her. Natalie walked over and extended her water bottle. "Sometimes when you're tired, the fountain is just too far away." Mia looked up and took the water bottle. After taking a few sips, she returned it to Natalie and said,
"Thank you, Miss Bellman."
"Yes," Coach Nick said. "Thank you. I'll take her to the trainer for a quick visit. No such thing as being too careful."
Nick stood up and extended his hand, and Mia took it, pulling herself to her feet.
"Feel better, Mia?"
Natalie called. Natalie knew about him, of course. Nicholas McGuire was a popular fixture at Falcon. In his weathered face was a hint of his formerly chiseled bone structure, and his eyes were an attractive shade of blue, though there were many creases at the corners. His body defied time, Natalie thought, watching him walk away with Mia. Even in his nerdy khaki shorts and tucked-in collared Falcon coaching polo, his muscles were clearly carved to perfection. Falcon parents, who were hard to impress since they all considered themselves one step away from royalty, liked to brag about him. At school events, Natalie had overheard conversations such as, "Did you know Coach Nick played 4 years for the UCLA men's soccer team?"
"I did. My husband told me he also played the inaugural year of the major soccer league for the San Jose team."
"Isn't he dating some famous model?"
"No, he's been in a long-distance relationship with a Canadian actress for the last couple of years. She was on that show Degrassi. I don't think she's done anything worth mentioning since."
Apparently, Coach Nick's personal misfortune had been a gift to the world of amateur athletics. During his first year of playing professional soccer, he tore his ACL. He was never able to go back, and so he began coaching. He was well-liked by Falcon dads because he was quick to give them fist bumps and pats on the back. He was a guy's guy. The moms liked him because he was easy on the eyes, but tough on his athletes. He had high expectations. There were always a few parents who were hoping for their children to get into prestigious colleges without the necessary grades, and in his 20 years of working around the country, Coach Nick had a notable record. Dozens of his athletes had been accepted to and played for UCLA, USC, Pepperdine, and Loyola Marymount. He was extremely well-connected in his home state of California. Natalie exited the gym and took the stairs up to the mezzanine, where a handful of students were having personal training sessions with various coaches. She marked her territory at a treadmill by hanging her towel and putting her water bottle in a holder. Instead of pressing start, she walked to the railing that looked out over the courts. Coach Nick had returned without Mia and was busy placing orange cones, balls, and mats around the gym to create an obstacle course. Natalie watched as he ran up and down the court, offering encouragement. She felt strangely drawn to him. He was supportive and instructive. For the next 10 minutes, while she did more than her normal amount of stretching by the balcony, her eyes never left Coach Nick. As Sloan Elliman Holt, one of the best athletes at the school, won a race, Coach Nick yelled,
"Bravo, speedster! Way to hustle!"
Natalie was overcome with a sense of longing and emptiness that she hadn't felt in years. At home that night, she wondered if she should get a cat. Maybe she should call her mom. She did. No answer. Consideration was given to creating an account on the new, outdoorsy dating app called Lovebird, but she was too nervous. She wondered who her ex-boyfriend in Denver was dating, and spent some time thinking about her dad. It had been a long time since a damp envelope of cash had arrived with a scrawled return address from somewhere in Nevada. She made plans to visit Jay the next day after work, and then settled down into bed to finish her book about a solitary, troubled woman in Scotland who found love with an unlikely match. A happy ending for the lonely lady. For Natalie, it was a two Vicodin night. 4. The restaurant table was covered with a red and white checkered tablecloth. In the center was a large, old-fashioned glass decanter filled with olive oil and floating heads of garlic. The song, "That's Amore," was playing in the background. It was just Asha and the kids. The fourth chair was empty. The server approached, pulling a pen from behind her ear.
"Okay, now are you ready?"
She'd been by twice already. Asha gave her an apologetic smile.
"Could I just give my husband 5 more minutes? He should be here any second."
The benches up by the hostess station were packed, and in the bar there were people milling around, waiting for tables. The server forced a smile.
"No problem. I'll check back shortly."
Oliver was playing a game on a rubber-encased iPad underneath the table, and Mia slouched silently, using her straw to suck up an inch of her iced tea and then squirt it back into her glass.
"Dad will be here soon,"
Asha said unhappily, fishing her phone out of her purse on the floor. She texted Phil.
"Honey, where are you? The kids are starving."
"Did you not just go ahead and order?"
"No, we were waiting for you."
"Please don't make everything about me. Nearly there."
Asha put her phone away, took a sip of water, and said to Mia,
"I think he's pretty close."
She felt like she should say more, but she had no energy. Truthfully, she wanted to turn her brain off to avoid thinking about anything at all. Earlier that day, she'd emptied the little trash can in her husband's office, and a hotel key card had fallen out. It was from the Le Méridien in downtown Denver, and the last place Phil had traveled for work, as far as she knew, was Phoenix. 15 minutes later, Asha finally saw Phil standing in the entrance to the dining room, looking this way and that. Asha wasn't the only person who'd noticed him. A few men and women had turned in his direction. He commanded attention. A former college basketball player, he was still a big, powerful, fit man. He had aged well and was always nicely dressed. Mia had gotten her athletic prowess from him. Oliver was more like Asha, a little on the soft side. Asha stood up and waved Phil over. As much as she wanted to open the conversation with a complaint about how late he was, she said, "Yay, you're here." Phil gave Asha a quick peck on the forehead and said,
"Sorry."
Then he ruffled the hair of both kids and said,
"You guys are starving, huh?"
Mia shrugged and said, "Not really." Oliver didn't even look up. "I could eat." So she'd lied about the kids starving. Phil often accused her of being passive-aggressive, and he was right. She couldn't help it. It was how her mom had been with her dad, and Asha still felt it was better than being openly confrontational. The look that Phil gave her made it abundantly clear that he was displeased with her. "Long day?" she asked, hoping to turn the tide as he removed his sports coat and took a seat.
"Yeah."
He unfolded his napkin and placed it across his big lap.
"How about you?"
So-so, Asha answered. Picking up the menu, Phil said,
"Okay, kids, devices away."
Mia turned her phone face down, but Oliver continued to play.
"Put your iPad away, Oliver, now."
"I just want to finish this level, Dad."
"I told him he could play until the food gets here," Asha said.
"Well," Phil said, "the food's not here, but I am, and I want him to put it away."
Oliver stood up and obediently handed his iPad to Asha so she could hold it for him. At that point, all three of her family members fell silent as they attempted to decide what they would eat. Asha quietly observed her husband, the military-style hair, the ruddy complexion, and the thick, muscular neck. They'd been together 17 years. Asha's parents had wanted her to marry a soft-spoken engineer whose parents were also from a small town outside of Mumbai, but Asha had already developed a huge crush on the big white hunk in her marketing ethics course at the University of Colorado. She still found his all-American masculinity appealing, but she couldn't help but wonder what would have happened had she gone with the gentle engineer, who, unlike Phil, had appreciated an aromatic saag paneer. She loved her husband, but something had changed. She was now married to a man who she was afraid to tell that she was pregnant. A man who had in his possession a key card to a room in a swanky, sexy hotel 90 minutes away. Had he totally lost interest in her, as it had lately seemed? And if so, what would he think of her late-in-life pregnancy? In her worst moments of anxiety, Asha imagined that Phil might believe she'd been aware of his wandering affection and had decided to find a way to hold him down. It wasn't true, exactly, though she had grown a bit lazy about taking her birth control pills on time, occasionally even missing a day or two. She hadn't been too worried about it, thinking she was getting old. The server appeared and was visibly relieved to find the empty chair now filled. Asha ordered first.
"You're not having a glass of wine?"
Phil asked.
"Not tonight."
Mia was immersed in what Phil called her great vegetarian experiment, and she ordered the eggplant parmesan. Oliver was still looking over the menu.
"Can I get the tour of Italy, please?"
he asked finally, blinking up at the server.
"Of course,"
the young lady answered cheerfully, probably pleased that the 11-year-old ordered the most expensive thing on the menu instead of something off the kids' menu, Asha thought. She could have cared less about the money, yet her expression was pinched and disapproving. Phil cleared his throat in a way that indicated exasperation.
"Something wrong?"
"Maybe Oliver doesn't need the tour of Italy."
"Why?"
Phil asked. Asha looked at her son as he vigorously masticated a piece of bread dripping with peppery Parmesan olive oil from the bowl next to his plate. She half expected him to grab the bowl and upend it into his mouth.
"I just mean, you know, that he could just choose one favorite. Quality over quantity, I like to say." "So, no tour of Italy?"
the server asked, looking at husband, then wife, and then back at husband.
"Let him get what he wants."
This from Mia, who was back to scrolling on her phone.
"I agree with Mia,"
Phil said, and Asha forced herself to turn away so he wouldn't be further incensed by her look of annoyance. After the server left, Asha inhaled deeply and changed the subject.
"So, Mia," Asha said,
I was wondering if you'd like to go with me to Best Buy next weekend and help me pick out a camcorder. I know you've been showing a lot of interest in photography lately.
Like, to make videos? Mia asked.
Yes, exactly.
I can make videos on my phone, Mia said, holding it up.
I know, but you can make even better ones with an expensive video camera. I think you could have a lot of fun with it. Mia considered it.
True, I'm definitely interested in filmmaking, so that might be cool.
The server slipped Asha and Phil's salads onto the table, and Phil picked up his fork. Instead of eating, he turned to Asha.
Where did this idea originate?
As Asha salted her tomatoes, she answered,
Brooke Elliman had a camcorder at the last game. The game when you were...
She looked at him pointedly in the eyes and said,
Out of town in Phoenix? She let me try it. It was really something. Great quality. She got it specifically to make Sloan a highlight reel for college recruiters.
Phil seemed unfazed by Asha's Phoenix reference, but then again, he had no idea she'd found his discarded key for a hotel in Denver. He glanced at Mia and then back at Asha.
What? Already?
That's exactly what I said, Asha answered. They're freshmen, but Brooke said it's not that early after all. Coach Nick told her a lot of Division I schools fill their upcoming team rosters while the girls are sophomores, which means we would need to have our whole package ready early next year.
Package?
Phil asked after a sip of wine.
What's in the package?
Mia began ticking off items on her fingers.
Highlight reel, about 5 to 8 minutes of me on the field with my best plays, photos, a personal essay, transcripts, recommendation letters, a list of tournaments and camps that I'm planning to attend so I can be scouted. I'll need to have all the coaches' email addresses and phone numbers so we can-
Asha,
Phil said, interrupting Mia.
Were you aware of all this? It sounds like a lot of work.
It wasn't until recently that Mia started to consider some bigger out-of-state Division I schools, so it's all kind of new to me, too.
All right,
he said.
Why Division I? What changed?
Because Coach Nick told me I'm Division I material. Me and Sloan, we both are.
Okay,
he said eventually.
And you're sure about this out-of-state idea?
Well, no, Mia said. I'm not 100% sure, but I can always change my mind, right? And stay in Colorado. But if I don't prepare for what I might want, then I won't even stand a chance.
Phil nodded.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
He shifted his attention to Asha.
I'll come with you to look at those video cameras.
Asha smiled at him.
Great.
I guess you have your work cut out for you, helping her with this.
Actually, Mia said, I can get extra help from Coach Nick, if that's okay. Sloan and Reed Leland and Jeremiah Solomon and some other kids do private training sessions after school and on the weekends. He makes videos of emerging skills and helps with essays. He also knows a lot about the colleges and coaches and what they're looking for, so he can be pretty helpful in, you know, narrowing down which are fallback schools and which are reach schools.
Phil was thinking as he chewed.
Your grades aren't great.
I know, Dad. I'm not thinking of, like, Stanford or Harvard.
Well, what are you thinking?
My fallbacks are Colorado State and Boulder, and my reach school is UCLA.
Asha put a hand on Phil's leg.
That's where Sloan wants to go, too. Supposedly Mr. McGuire has some pull there.
I think I knew that,
Phil said.
Brooke talks a lot about it, doesn't she?
Asha nearly asked him when exactly he'd been spending so much time talking to Brooke. As far as she knew, the two of them had done no more than sit several chairs apart at a soccer game for years. But Phil went on.
I'm not an expert, but I can hypothesize that pull or no pull, Coach Nick's not going to get UCLA to take two girls the same age from Falcon Academy.
The food was arriving, and Mia picked up her fork and knife.
For once, Sloan may not get what she wants.
Asha nodded in agreement.
Brooke won't like that.
Phil moved his hand underneath the table to where only Asha could see it and extended his middle finger. He mouthed,
Fuck Brooke.
The smile on his face was a little sneaky, and Asha didn't like it. Occasionally, she had an unpleasant flashback to the night she and Phil had been invited to Brooke's house for dinner, and Asha had walked out onto the patio to find her husband and the hostess huddled together, smoking a joint and laughing by the swimming pool like teenagers. It suddenly occurred to Asha that Phil had started disengaging with her at home just about the same time that Gabe had informed Brooke he didn't consider reconciliation an option. Asha gave Phil's hand a little good-natured swat with her napkin. Brooke was her friend, and though she could be difficult at times, to mouth, "fuck Brooke," wasn't funny. Asha didn't respond out loud, but what she was thinking was, "You probably want to." 5. Brooke Elliman stood outside the bullet-resistant glass door of the school, holding up her driver's license to the camera. She wore a knee-length suede vest with a hood and cream-colored equestrian riding tights with leather accents. With her long, straight hair spilling down to her waist, she looked powerful and wild, like she might have just arrived straight from the steppes, having galloped in bareback on one of her purebred Arabians. Natalie stood up and went over to the window facing the parking lot. "Yvonne," she said out of the side of her mouth. "Shit, I thought so. It's Mrs. Elliman." They both knew Mrs. Elliman was not at the school to drop off some canned goods or old clothes. None of her frequent visits were anything short of electrically charged. Outside, Mrs. Elliman pocketed her driver's license and waited, arms crossed, one pointy Western riding boot tapping on the sidewalk. Every visitor was vetted by Rex, the security guard, before being buzzed into the atrium. In Mrs. Elliman's case, Rex would simply be going through the motions. Everyone knew her. She was the sole heir to the Elliman baked goods fortune and had retained her maiden name after marrying Sloane's dad, Gabe Holt. Brooke had always enjoyed the esteem that came along with her family's reputation and had insisted that Sloane use the hyphenated Elliman Holt surname to ensure that her daughter received the same immediate recognition and befitting respect that she herself had been shown her whole life. Rex buzzed her through the front door, and a second later, she entered the office, accompanied by a gust of cool air and the barely there woodsy hint of a jasmine perfume.
"Good afternoon, Mrs. Elliman,"
Yvonne said brightly.
"Will you be needing a visitor's badge for the campus?"
"I don't think that will be necessary," she said. "I'm just here to see Mark." She was one of a handful of parents who didn't call him Headmaster Dilly. On Natalie's desk was an apple-shaped nameplate that said, "Miss Bellman," in cursive script that she'd been given upon hiring, a small, framed watercolor of Jay's dog, Rocky, and a whimsically painted coffee mug filled with pens. She produced a sign-in log, opened it, and smoothed the pages out.
"Can I just get your autograph and the reason for your visit?" Natalie asked.
"I already said so. I just need to speak to Mark."
"Okay," Yvonne said. "Let me just make sure he's available. He probably is, for you, but I'll just check. Be right back."
"Thank you." Mrs. Elliman sighed and ran her hands through her tremendous amount of hair. Then she consulted her silver and turquoise watch. Natalie asked,
"Can I get you anything to—"
"I don't want anything to drink, thank you," Mrs. Elliman answered loudly, and somehow the "thank you" came across as "fuck you." The headmaster emerged from his office.
"Mrs. Elliman,"
he said warmly, as if her visit was a wildly appreciated treat.
"Hello, what can I do for you?"
"I need to talk about—" She cut herself off before saying Sloane. Natalie and Yvonne both politely averted their eyes. "Something important," Brooke concluded.
"Say no more," Mr. Dilly responded. "Come into the study, won't you?"
The door to his office actually had a sign on it that read, "The Study." Mr. Dilly didn't like to call students, teachers, or parents into his office. He said that "headmaster's office" sounded pejorative. It was comfortable in the study, with books, photos of his two Welsh corgis, his overflowing ferns on the windowsill, and the smell of the leather polish that the cleaning staff massaged routinely into the matching ottoman and armchair. Mr. Dilly closed the study door. A short time after, a slightly flushed Mr. McGuire came walking quickly down the hall and into the office. He wasn't wearing any sort of cap, but he pretended to doff one anyway, saying,
"Afternoon, ladies."
He was dressed in his usual getup of cargo shorts and a light blue Falcon polo, accessorized by his ubiquitous whistle on a rope. Natalie didn't realize she was smiling at him until he returned it enthusiastically.
Nice to see you again.
He touched her Apple nameplate and said,
Miss Bellman, thank you for your thoughtfulness the other day when one of my athletes was a little under the weather.
You're very welcome, Mr. McGuire, Natalie responded.
I would love to stay and chat with the two of you, but I'm afraid I've been summoned to the study, and I get the impression I better not dilly-dally.
He had never before said more than a few words to either of them when he came to see the headmaster.
Well, Natalie said, whatever you do, don't dilly-dally.
Natalie gestured around.
This is a top speed area only. Please, we don't tolerate dilly-dallying here in the front office.
Yvonne covered her mouth to hide a giggle. Mr. McGuire shook his finger at Natalie.
That's not fair. I'm a coach and a gym teacher. I'm not used to people making fun of me.
Natalie was about to quip back when Mr. Dilly buzzed.
Can one of you find out what's taking Mr. McGuire so long?
He asked in a strained voice.
See?
He whispered.
I told you. I dilly-dallied because of you. It's all your fault, Miss Spellman.
He then passed behind them into the study. Yvonne leaned sideways toward Natalie and whispered,
Mrs. Elliman is on the warpath. Looks like some shit is going down.
At 4 o'clock, when Natalie was done with her work and the office was quiet, she grabbed her backpack and headed over to the sports pavilion. In the girls' locker room, she changed into shorts, running shoes, and an old tie-dyed tank top she'd had forever. Her blunt-cut auburn hair hit an inch above her shoulders. It was too short for a proper ponytail, but she pulled it back off her face into a little tuft above her long neck. It was surprisingly empty up on the mezzanine. Usually there were at least a few coaches and students, but on this afternoon there appeared to be just the head of the custodial staff, an older man named Harry Doyle. He was using an electric screwdriver to affix some sort of lock onto the training room door, and it was loud. Natalie shouted,
Hi, Harry!
He turned off his drill long enough to say,
Hello there, Natalie.
It's empty up here, isn't it?
Lots of away games today,
he said, firing his tool up again. It was nice having the whole place to herself, so Natalie wasn't particularly pleased to see Sloane Elliman Holt walk in from the staircase, drop her backpack to the ground, and look around expectantly. Many girls at the school were extremely smart. Half a dozen were uniquely physically talented. Almost all of the students at Falcon, except for a few on scholarship or whose parents worked at the school and paid lower tuition, were wealthy. Sloane had it all, though her grades didn't show it. She was also a mean girl, most of the time. From what Natalie had discerned from her voyeuristic position behind her desk, there was only one girl who Sloane treated with anything other than disinterest or outright contempt. It was Mia Wilson, and even that relationship was mercurial at best. At times, they could be seen walking down the hall with their arms linked. At other times, a teacher would show up with the pair of them in the front office, reporting that they'd been shoving one another around in the girls' bathroom. Sloane spotted Natalie in the corner, waved, and walked over.
Hi, Sloane. How are you?
Natalie said loudly over the noise from the drill, placing her free weights down on the ground.
Fine, thanks. You haven't seen Coach Nick or the trainer, have you? Coach Carmen?
No, sorry. I haven't seen either of them. Thankfully, Harry took another break from his work, and they could hear one another without shouting.
That's okay.
Sloane seemed to be staring at Natalie's chest. After a second, she said,
I like your shirt.
It seemed like Sloane's compliment was an attempt to deflect a hint of scorn. Natalie looked down at the tie-dye and laughed.
Oh, this? It's old. I made it myself. What? You did? Yeah, I mean, I did the design. Wow.
Sloane nodded appreciatively.
So, what are you doing up here?
Her tone indicated that she was bored and filling the time.
I only ever see you in the office.
Oh, I just started using the school gym a little bit ago. Whole Life Fitness raised my membership by $20, and I was told it was okay if I just work out here instead. Sloane mulled this over while regarding Natalie with curiosity. Natalie realized that this was the sort of problem the girl could simply not comprehend. $20, a quarter. These were meaningless amounts of money.
Cool. What time is it anyway?
Sloane asked. She readjusted the hairband around the ponytail starting high on the crown of her head.
The trainer is supposed to be here. I have to get a shot.
A shot? What kind of shot?
An anti-inflammatory for my knee. I damaged my meniscus, and my mom's worried I'm not playing my best, so now I have to do private sessions and see the trainer. My mom's all worried about which school I'm going to get into, so...
You're only a freshman, right?
Yeah, but Coach Nick is going to get me scouted and signed next year. At least, that's what my mom thinks. He told her he's going to do everything within his power. He's got connections.
After a brief break, Harry started drilling again, and Sloane covered her ears.
Ugh, who is he?
That's Mr. Doyle, Natalie answered, slightly baffled. Harry was around the school all day, every day, whistling and cleaning.
You don't know Mr. Doyle? No, what's he doing?
He's... Natalie stopped and looked over at Harry.
So what are you up to there, Harry?
Just putting a lock on the door. Coach Carmen keeps medications in here.
Sloane shrugged her shoulders and turned to look back at the entrance of the mezzanine, just as Coach Carmen walked in carrying a first aid kit. Natalie waved to the trainer, who she knew only in passing. She was a muscular lady who had nearly made it to the 2012 Olympics in shot put. Coach Carmen waved back at Natalie, but she was focused on Sloane.
I'm a little late. Sorry, training room, please.
Natalie watched Sloane trudge childishly behind Coach Carmen, behaving as if she'd been sent to bed early. The two of them continued into the training room, passing Harry, who seemed to have finished his work and was packing up his toolbox. A few minutes later, when Sloane and Coach Carmen appeared back out on the fitness floor for stretching, Natalie slipped in her earbuds and searched for some good running music on her phone. As she started on the treadmill at a walking pace, she wondered what it would be like to be Sloane. So wealthy and talented that the world was your oyster. So special that Coach Nick would do everything in his power to make you happy. Behind Natalie's back, whatever Coach Carmen was doing to Sloane was causing the girl to make a loud noise that was somewhere between a whine and a scream. Natalie bumped up her speed from walking to jogging and focused on the machine beneath her feet. The cries from across the room might as well have been coming from a television show. Natalie felt little to no sympathy. She seriously doubted Sloane had ever known any real pain at all.